It's a story that I have talked about a lot, and I imagine it's a story that you're going to know really well. And I'm sad to do this to you, but if you only know this story as it's typically talked about, I may ruin David and Goliath for you. So, you know, if you don't want that to happen, I apologize in advance. But this story has captured my imagination for years, as I'm sure it has many of you. Many of us, we've all had somebody who at some point or another, you know, they got out the big cardboard and they made like a 9-foot-tall Goliath, and you know, they talked about this underdog story. They talked about, you know, the fact that David had no chance of winning, and that, you know, God allowed him to win even though, you know, he had all these things sort of stacked against him. Before we get to that part though, geography is important, especially in this story, and you'll see why as we go through it more. But geography is a little important. So in Israel, you have some of the major cities that you know of in Israel are in the mountains. So you've got Hebron, you've got Jerusalem, you've got Bethlehem. They're high up in the mountains. And, you know, right around the ocean, you've got a very fertile plain. So the Philistines in our story, they actually live on the plains. They live in the lowlands and they want to invade Israel. So, you know, they get their army together and they march toward the mountains. Well, between the mountains and the plain, there's an area of Israel known as the Shephelah. And the Shephelah is, you know, a bunch of valleys that run east to west between the two. And if you want to invade the mountains, you have to go through the Shephelah. And the reason this is important is because as these, you know, seafaring Philistines essentially start marching through the Shephelah, they go up on one of these ridges going from, you know, east, going in their case from west to east. They march along one of these ridges. Saul hears that they're coming. So Saul marshals his forces together and he starts marching down the Shephelah in the opposite way. He gets along one of the top of these ridges and he starts marching along the other side to, you know, meet the enemy and to, you know, protect Israel. He's the first king. This is his job. Somewhere along the way they meet. And what happens is, you know, Saul is on one ridge and the Philistines are on another ridge. Neither one of them can attack. Neither one of them can, you know, do anything about the other guys over there. You can't move east to west. You can't move forward or backward. You're trapped exactly where you are. There is nowhere for you to go because, well, to march on the other side is suicide. There's no possible way that you can go to the other side and fight. And so they sit there absolutely deadlocked for weeks. Because, I mean, and think about this for a second. If you can imagine standing on a ridge, looking across a valley at another ridge where your enemy is, that means that if you're going to invade, if you're going to fight the enemy, you have to march down your side of the ridge, you have to cross a wide open plain, and then you have to march up the other side of the ridge, and now you're fighting your enemy from downhill, which if you've ever seen, you know, some of the Star Wars movies, you know that that's not a good thing. If you have somebody has the high ground, they're going to win. You know, so you can't do it. So both of the armies sit there week after week after week waiting for something to happen. And eventually what happens is the Philistines send their biggest, their strongest warrior to fight in single combat for all the marbles. Now this, you know, would be famous in Greece and in Rome and throughout the world, in other contexts, with other armies, with other fighters. But probably the best known story is this exact story, where, you know, we know, Goliath goes out in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 8, he says, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." And the Israelites are absolutely terrified. Because depending on your, you know, your particular reference points, depending upon, you know, which Dead Sea Scroll you want to look at or which manuscript evidence you trust, he's either 9 feet tall or 7 feet tall, roughly. I don't think it makes much difference to me. You know, let's imagine he's just 6'9". Let's imagine he's just as tall as LeBron James is. Let's imagine that he's just got the sword and the long javelin, that he's just got the shield bearer, that he's wearing 100 pounds of glittering armor from head to toe. No one wants to fight him. And so they sit there for weeks. And eventually a shepherd boy shows up. And that's where this story gets interesting, but that's also where, you know, we need to start getting into our actual lesson. So how do you protect your friends and family? Well, the first thing that I want us to recognize about this story, before I start throwing curveballs in here, is that you have to be willing to accept help. And I say this very explicitly. I say this because obviously our discussion is on how do you help your friends and family. Well, the first thing I want you to understand is that if you're not willing to accept help from others, they're not going to be willing to accept help from you either. How many of you would like it if your friends thought of you as the person who has it all together, who has all the answers, who's never flustered, who knows everything, and who always has exactly what they need to have at the right time? I don't need any help. I can handle this on my own. It'd be kind of nice if everybody thought of you that way. Is that true? Are there times where you need some help? Are there times where you'd like to have somebody that you could talk to, that you could ask advice from? I hope so, because there are, whether you admit it or not. But if you're not willing to accept help, others aren't going to be willing to take the help that you offer either. And we see this in the text, actually, because David shows up, and in verse 28, David's going around and he's asking about what's going on, and he's trying to figure out how he can help in this situation. And then Eliab, his brother, hears him speaking with the men. He burns with anger, and he goes to his brother, and he asks him, "Why have you come down here? With whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are, how wicked your heart is. You came down lonely to watch the battle." Now notice exactly what Eliab is saying and how Eliab thinks of David. Now I'm not going to parse out whether he's accurate or not. I don't know David. I've never met him before. He's a little before my time. But what does Eliab think about his younger brother? "I know how conceited you are, how wicked your heart is. I know how tiny your life is back home. I don't need your help. I don't want your help. I don't want you to be in my life. I want you to get out of here." You know, and David showed up to try to help his family. And for a lot of different reasons, Eliab wants none of it. His younger brother's making him look bad. Eliab is defensive because he is the older brother. Eliab's defensive because he's the one who should have all the answers. He's the one who should do all the things. He's the one who should fight Goliath before David does. So Eliab doesn't want to have any help. He doesn't want somebody to help him out. But no one does want help. No one wants to admit that they are weak, that they are flawed, that they have difficulties, that they have struggles that they cannot handle on their own. But there's a secret to life, is that we can handle it on our own. That's why we have each other. That's why we are a community. That's what church is for. God created us to be able to handle a lot of stuff, but we can't do it on our own. No one wants to look vulnerable, though, around someone who is invulnerable. And so the first thing I want us to understand is that if you want to protect, if you want to defend your friends and your family, the first thing that you have to understand is that you are in this together and that you can't do it on your own. So other people, they can come to you because, you know, we're all working together. And the second, I guess, is to help with no strings attached. And we see this in the story too. So David's brothers, they're fighting with Saul. They're in the army. David's dad keeps sending him back and forth with stuff and with food and all this different stuff. And one day, after a month of doing this, you know, David goes up to Saul and he says, "Hey, listen, I'll take care of this giant that you have. Do you mind if I take care of this problem for you?" In fact, actually what he says in verse 32, he says, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." And of course, you know, Saul's absolutely thrilled about this. He says, "Absolutely not. There's no possible way I'm going to let you fight the giant because you don't stand a chance. You're a kid." And verse 33 says, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him because you're only a boy and he's been a fighting man from his youth." Now this is where, to a degree, our story picks up a little, because sometimes we look at stories like this kind of like a fairy tale. Like, it's just an object lesson. It's just an idea. And so we kind of overlook some of the problems in the text. We just don't even think about them. We don't deal with different things that we really should, because there are answers, but there aren't answers if we never ask the question. So, and you can answer if you know, why does Saul even send David in the first place? Like, why does he even... Because remember, this is man-to-man combat. And if Goliath dies, Israel wins. But what happens if David dies? So why does he let David go? Knowing what's at stake, why does he let David go into battle? Anybody have any thoughts? Yes. Sorry, let me scoot back here a little more. Well, everybody else was too scared, but as long as they're sitting there, and as long as nobody goes in to fight, you haven't lost. You look like you have an answer.
Well, Saul had a spirit of evil in him. And because he was disobedient to God. And maybe Saul didn't want to win.
Maybe. That's a little later in the story. Okay, I'll give you the answer. Because the more you think about it, the harder this gets until you kind of work through this. David's not in the army. David's not a soldier. So if David wanders down into the battlefield and gets his own fool self killed, I don't know who that kid is. Just wandered in there. I'm glad you got some target practice. I'm glad you got that out of your system, Goliath. But he wasn't in the military. He wasn't on our side. He doesn't count. Right? Oh, this was between one army and another. He's not in the army. See, if David wins, everybody wins. And if David loses, man, he's had a bad day. But it doesn't hurt the rest of us. See, what I want you to understand about David here is that David is fighting with no strings attached. If what David does is right, it's great. And if what David does is wrong, if this doesn't work out, if it doesn't help, this isn't going to cause everyone to go into slavery. So how many times in our life do we help, but we help with strings attached? You know, we don't mind helping somebody else out as long as they know, you know, they owe us one. Or as long as they understand exactly what's going on here. See, David's a shepherd and not a soldier, and so it doesn't hurt them anything. It just helps them. But how many times do we invite our friends to church? And I've done this before as well. How many times do we invite our friends to church and our friend knows that, well, there are strings attached to this? Because if I go to this event, then they're going to want me to start going to church, or they're going to start wanting me to do this, or to do that, or to continue this. And to be honest with you, sometimes people don't want to, you know, have that relationship with us and that relationship with God, because they know we're expecting a long-term commitment. And they're not ready for that yet. How many times do we help someone with the understanding that if we help them, then, you know, they're going to go along with some goals that we have? And so one of the things I want to encourage you to do, especially with your family, especially with your friends, is to understand that understand what Christ did for us. He helped us. How many miracles do we see Christ doing where after the miracle is over, he says, "Now I expect you to fully dedicate the rest of your life to God"? Pretty rare that happens. He does occasionally. He will tell somebody, you know, and in fact, it wasn't a miracle. He did kind of save her life. You know, but he tells the woman in John 8, you know, go and sin no more. But that wasn't even a string attached. That was just like good practical advice. Listen, if you don't want to get stoned, try to straighten your life up. How many times did Christ offer us grace before we became a Christian, before we knew who God was? And so whenever we say that help with no strings attached, we understand that that's because we want, our purpose is to help our friends and our family. The next part is where we start discussing things that are a little different with David and Goliath than we might think. And that's the fact that we have to, if we're going to help our friends and family, we must understand what our strengths are. We must understand what makes us valuable, what makes us prepared for our battle. So David goes to get 5 stones from the river. And he goes down and the giant taunts David. In verse 43, he says, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? Come here and I'll give you your flesh to the birds of the air, to the beasts of the field." And of course, before Goliath can make good on the threats, David loads up the sling and he hurls the rock at this glittering armed giant. He hits him between the eyes and he falls down, dead or unconscious. We don't really know. David proceeds to separate his head from his shoulders. And this is the point of the story where we say, well, this is what the David and Goliath story is, right? This is, the guy that had no chance beating the guy that expected to win. In fact, when we use the phrase David and Goliath, what we mean is a story where the victor had no chance of winning and the loser had no imagining that they would lose, right? That's what it means. What if I told you that isn't what it is? And that pretty much everything we understand about the David and Goliath story is wrong. Because we're so busy painting our own picture of what is that we don't actually take the time to look for what God is really saying in the text. So what I want to do for a second, I want you to enumerate the ways in which David is the underdog in our story. How is David the underdog here? What does he have going against him? He has no fighting experience. He's never fought before.
Size.
Yeah, David is a 28 short and Goliath is a 43 long. So how do you fight a man that's that big? How do you fight a man who has all this battle experience when you have none? What else? What are some other things you can think of? What's that? Yeah, not only has he never fought before, he's a kid. He's still young, and this Goliath's been fighting since he was young. And so just age in general is going to help Goliath out. Are there some things that are a little more visible on Goliath that might help him win?
Goliath had an awesome sword.
He had a sword that David would carry around the rest of his life. David would carry this thing around like a trophy. So I don't know what it looked like, but I've always imagined the Thundercat sword just because I'm a child of the 80s. Yeah, there's nothing like this anywhere in the world. Like this is Goliath's sword. So he has a sword. He has armor. He has his own personal shield bearer. He's got a javelin that looks like a weaver's beam. So he has all these. He has the highest degree of technical, powerful, modern weaponry that you could possibly imagine. While David has a sling. So David doesn't even have a real weapon. Like he's not even going to battle with a real weapon. He doesn't have any armor. He doesn't have a sword. He has no weapon, just a sling. And that's what Saul thought too. In verse 38 it says that Saul clothed David with his garments, put a bronze helmet on his head. He clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over the armor and he tried to walk, for he hadn't tested them. And David said to Saul, "I can't go with these. I've not tested them." And David took them off. So he has the chance to wear armor, and he gives up, which goes back to the youth and maybe the fighting experience. Like, David, you should know better than this. At least wear the armor. Maybe you'll make it past two swings, and you'll be able to do something. But he goes without it. And this is where we miss the point, because in the ancient world, there are three kinds of troops. And even today, there are basically three kinds of troops. Number one, you've got cavalry. So you think of Genghis Khan, you think of Attila the Hun, you think of the chariots, that's cavalry. That is a branch of the military at this time. You've got infantry. This is swords and shields and armor and breastplates and boots and marching and, all that kind of thing. You think of the phalanx in Greece, you think of Goliath. Then you have artillery. Artillery is pretty powerful. Artillery is one of the biggest reasons why France fell and why, Belgium fell as quickly as they did in World War II. But artillery in the ancient world, well, it wasn't artillery. It was bows and arrows, and it was slingers. David's a slinger. That's what he is. That's what he does. That's what he's trained his whole life for. See, David has a cord. It has a wide piece of leather in the middle. And then he would take a stone that's about a pound and a half. So if you've ever played softball, imagine a softball that's not a softball, but it's a softball that's a rock. and you've roughly got a pound and a half stone. So we're talking like a major heavy stone. Again, a pound and a half. And I don't know about you, but I always think of like, I always thought of like, you know, when David was going to hurl the stone, like it was like he had a lasso and he was like swinging it over his head and then he would just like let it fly. And that's not what happened. Have you ever seen a fast pitch softball pitcher? That's how you throw one of these stones. And one of these stones, well, they would be able to throw it around well over 70 miles an hour. And so it would have the stopping force, it would have the energy roughly of a 45 Magnum. So it hits pretty hard. It was an absolutely devastating weapon. This is not a slingshot. This isn't like a slingshot. This is a devastating weapon that militaries used all the time. In fact, there are a lot of records of people throwing rocks from a sling that are accurate enough to hit a bird while it's in flight. Now, what has David done with a sling before? What has he done already? What has he killed with a sling? He names two animals. Bueller. What has he killed with a sling before? He's killed a lion and a bear. We have a dog. Who has a dog? Have you ever tried to outrun your dog? Has anyone ever outran their dog? Besides like when their dog was a puppy. Like a full grown. You ever tried to outrun a dog before? You know the old story about the bear. You know where the guy's being chased by a bear and he stops to tie his shoes. And the guy's like, why are you trying to tie your shoes? We can't outrun a bear. And he says, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. You know the idea there that this bear is going to outrun both of us. See, if David's already killed a lion, he's already killed a bear, he's already killed animals that are much faster and much stronger and much stealthier than Goliath could ever hope to be. As a slinger, David has every intention, he has every expectation to hit Goliath exactly where he aims and for it to kill him. Every expectation. This is like shooting fish in a barrel for David. This is not a wish and a hope. This is a man who has been trained for this moment so that he has every expectation that he's gonna kill Goliath. Goliath does not stand a chance. Which brings us to a really important question that we have to deal with. And the reason I've spent so much time on this at this point is because I want you to understand that if David had fought the battle the way everyone else wanted him to, he would have lost. If David had tried to use other people's skills, if David had sat around and said, well, you know, if I were better at this, if I were better at that, or if I had been trained to do this, or if I had this, or if I were taller, or if I had better weapons, or if I could do this, then maybe I could beat him. Then maybe I could go into battle. If I had all this stuff, then maybe it would work. He doesn't do that, though. What does he have? We call it a toy. We say he doesn't have a real weapon. But it is what David has. And what we find out is, in the battle that he was fighting, it was the very best thing he possibly could have had. It guaranteed him victory. There is no way Goliath walks off this field. None. This is not a battle. It's an execution. There's no hope. And yet, if he'd done what we wanted him to do, he'd lost. So what are your skills? What are you good at? What are you passionate about? What do you like? What have you had success in? Because those are the things that later on are going to help you do the same thing in your life that David does in his own. Use the tools that you have. In fact, in Romans 12 and verse 6, Paul says, since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, each of us is to exercise them accordingly. And so he's saying, don't ask for the gifts that you want. Don't want the gifts you don't have. What do I have? See, we spend so long looking at Goliath that we spend no time at all looking at the sling that's in our own pocket. We spend so long thinking about the battles we have yet to fight and the things that we'd like to do and the things that we want to do and the things we would like to be prepared for at some point in the future that we forget there are battles we're fighting right now that we are equipped right now to win. And yet we don't fight them. And what ends up happening is that we're not there to help our friends and our family when they're in this deadlock in life. So let me ask you, what's David's purpose here? Why is he on that battlefield at that time, in that moment? What's his purpose? Is his purpose to kill Goliath? Well, kind of. Yeah. But his real purpose is to break the deadlock that's happened between these two armies. Let me ask you, what could Israel do? What good could they do in the world while their army and their king is sitting on a hill in the middle of nowhere, staring an army down across a ravine? Nothing. They spent a month staring across this valley at an army on the other side doing absolutely squat. They can't do anything good. They can't do anything that's beneficial to anybody in the world. David's purpose is to break that deadlock. David's purpose is to allow Israel to do the things that only Israel can do, but that they can't do as long as they're being held hostage by the Philistines. They're trapped by the Philistines. They're trapped by fear. And we see in verse 51, after this battle is over, it says, when the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and they ran. And you have people in your life who are in a deadlock. Maybe it's sin, maybe it's temptation, maybe it's fear. Maybe they want to study the Bible, but they don't really know how to study the Bible. Maybe they want to start living a certain way, but they don't really know what that's going to look like, or they need somebody to help them along the way. Many times your job is not to help someone do right versus doing wrong. It's to help them stop being ineffective and start being effective. Start doing the great things over just the good things. You know people that haven't grown or maybe even haven't fought in these battles before. And your job is to step into their life and help them through this logjam so that they can start being effective, which is what Israel could not have been for this extreme amount of time. The other thing I want to mention to you is to look for opportunities. I mean, after all, we've mentioned this before, but what is Goliath? I said before, we have chariots, we have cavalry, we've got the slingers, who are artillery. Then we've got Goliath. What's Goliath? Infantry. That's what he's always been. He's the heaviest infantry there is. And everything hinges upon our expectation that this is a battle of infantry versus infantry. And this is said throughout the chapter. In verse 8, Goliath says, why do you come out and line up for battle? Choose a man, have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we'll become your servants. In verse 37, which we read a minute ago, Saul dressed David in his tunic and put a coat of armor on him. In verse 43, Goliath says, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? Because apparently he thinks that he's going to come in there and fight him as a, you know, some kind of, you know, Eastern martial artist. He says, you don't even bring a sword, you brought sticks. In verse 48, it says, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. And even the author of the text wants us to anticipate this being a battle of infantry versus infantry. I have my strongest guy, you have your strongest guy, and everyone assumes that David is going to fight Goliath hand to hand. And of course, everything we know is telling us now, why would he? Why would you set down this perfectly good, useful, guaranteed to win weapon so that you can fight a highly trained, devastating, weapon lumbering giant who basically is a target with 100 pounds of armor on? Why would you do that? Well, it's because you wouldn't think about who David is and what David can do. Again, we spend so long looking at our giants that we forget to look at our slings. We spend so long looking for opportunities we'd like to take advantage of that we forget to look for the ones we can take advantage of. We spend so long thinking about the people we'd like to impact that we forget to look at the people that we can impact, the people that we can help, the people that we can encourage. Paul does this in Philippians 1. In verse 12, he's writing to the church at Philippi, and he says, my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that in my imprisonment in the cause of Christ, it has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. Now again, essentially what's going on here is, you know, Paul's been thrown in prison. And essentially what he says is, you know, this whole prison thing, it's working out pretty well because I'm able to meet people in prison I can never meet outside of prison. It's a nice way to look at prison. especially when you're thrown in prison so that you don't preach to people, to go to prison and start looking at who you can impact instead of the people that you can't. The last thing I want to mention is to know your enemy. Now, we misjudge David. We misjudge his weapons. We misjudge his intent. We misjudge why he's there and what he can do. But we also misjudge Goliath. See, for about 40 years, we've kind of known that Goliath has acromegaly. You know people with acromegaly. Some of the tallest giants in the world, some of the most famous giants in the world have acromegaly. Robert Wadlow is the tallest man who ever lived. He died at 24 years old. When he died, he was still growing, and he was 7 foot 11. He had acromegaly. If you're old like me, you'll know Andre the Giant. Andre the Giant had acromegaly. Acromegaly is a medical condition where on your pituitary gland, you begin growing a tumor. And that tumor affects the way that you grow, and it causes you to keep growing, you know, long after and long beyond when you should have stopped. The problem is that acromegaly has some side effects, mainly to do with vision. See, when you have acromegaly, it causes you to have double vision, it causes you to have blurry vision, it causes you to be profoundly nearsighted. And this makes sense. After all, in the verse we read a minute ago, remember Goliath says, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" Well, how many sticks did David have? One. So why does Goliath say, "Why do you come at me with sticks?" Plural. Because he can't see him. He just hears the stick rattling around and assumes he has multiple sticks. Why does he have a shield carrier? I know Jonathan had a shield carrier too. Probably had a shield carrier because he couldn't see well enough to get down into the battlefield. Which doesn't matter if you're infantry because you're fighting someone who's 4 inches in front of your face. But if you're fighting a slinger who's 100 yards away, being profoundly nearsighted, that's a problem. There's another verse I want to point out to you in verse 48 that if you haven't ever noticed it before, I find fascinating. Because in verse 48, it says that the Philistine rose, which means he got up off the ground, and came, meaning he started walking, and he drew near to meet David. So this man is in the middle of a life or death situation, and he's walking to David. He's strolling along, going to fight David. Why would you walk to a battle? Because you can't see well enough to run. So David's going into this battle. Israel is terrified, but they're terrified of a weak, short-sighted, limited, slow, in pain giant. They spend so long thinking about what the giant could do that they forget about the giant's weaknesses. Now, I don't want to make this too specific here. I don't want to indicate that this is the purpose, but I couldn't help but think about the fact that that's exactly what we do so often. We spend so long thinking about how powerful our temptations are, or our fears are, or our difficulties are, that we forget. We forget that God's on our side. We forget the weaknesses of our enemy. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, he says, "Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. But resist him." And he says, "After you've suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you." And essentially what Peter is saying is, he might be wandering around, but he's still toothless. He's still weaker than, well, God is. We still have God on our side. So don't forget who your enemy is. Don't forget who you're fighting against. Your enemy is not your friends. Your enemy is not your family. Your enemy isn't the person in school that you don't like. They're not your enemy. They might be misguided. They might be wrong. They might be mean. They might be difficult, but they're not your enemy. Peter says that Satan is the enemy. And you have the tools to help your friends and your family fight the battles that they need to fight now. But the only way that's going to happen is if you recognize the tools you have. The things that you are passionate about, the skills that you have, and use those things to help win the battles that maybe no one else can.